Colin Ryder Richardson, Veal 2, you were talking about sort of playing in the sort of windy weather. Who were you playing with? Who were these other people? Can you remember their names?
Yeah. Probably I was playing with Derek and Sonia and Barbara, who also, like myself, private evacuees. But to be frank, I think I was... And I wasn't playing with them. Was in the cocktail lounge, because I seem to remember some ladies having cocktails and always give me their cherry on the cocktails, things like that. And I think that's where I got my nickname, Royal Scarlet, from.
The cherry and your jacket, yes.
So really, life on the ship was enjoyable, but when the winds got up, then it became more sometimes nice to go to your cabin and read my books and comics, things like that. And as I say, I hardly ever saw the journalists, whether or whether what he had got up to. But you know, at night I'd go to bed about 7, 8, 9 o'clock, depending on how I felt, and I usually was asleep before he arrived in his bed, and he usually was up before me in the morning. I think really my mind was more set on how long would it take to get across the Atlantic. Amazement to see that being told the escorts, our naval escorts, had gone. This was the day before we were torpedoed. They said, well, the ships have got to be escorted back into Britain in the area where the U-boats we now operate. But unfortunately, this was all out of date in their knowledge, because the Germans, having conquered France, immediately transposed their operations to French naval bases rather from German naval bases. That meant that the range of the submarines could extend right across the Atlantic rather than sort of 800 miles off the British coast.
Did you feel more vulnerable without the escort? From what you were saying earlier, you know, with your pleasure, really, that the weather had roughened up, it would seem that you were very conscious of your vulnerability.
Yes. I didn't know the range of a submarine or anything else like that, but one is always feels that maybe we haven't taken everything into account. So... I was disappointed, put it like that, to think that the naval escort had gone. I could see the reasons that they had to, that they were short of ships, and that in a day or so we would be picked up by Canadian destroyers from the other side. So it was this gap in the middle. I suppose it's the middle third of the Atlantic that was, we were unaccompanied. And I was disappointed, because I really felt that submarines probably could guard there. They had extra fuel tanks if they wanted to. It struck me as not beyond the realms of possibility of striking where you're almost vulnerable. I mean, being a boy, I suppose you're more interested in military matters than otherwise. And one looked at the thing from your own safety point of view, as well as an incredible, you know, expanse of the wars in general. I mean, how taking it, you're nearly in America, and here's a European war, and how far does it go into the ocean? And I realised the Germans had probably got very fine machines, so quite at all surprised. In fact, when we were torpedoed, from that point of view, I mean, there was a war till 10 o'clock at night.
Where were you when it happened? Were you in bed?
Yes, I was in bed, and I was just about to go to sleep. And I'd put a ball bearing that I seem to have acquired in the top drawer of my desk, I think, between the two bunks, just to see how rough the sea was, because it would clip from one side to the other as it rolled backwards and forwards. And there's a sort of comforting sound, because if I could hear that clicking, clicking, I thought, well, because it's rough sea, we're almost virtually not going to be torpedoed, but it is still there, a possibility. And then the next minute there was a loud bang, very loud bang, and almost immediately a smell of presumably cordite or something like that. It was an unmistakable smell. And a lot of shouts. So I immediately knew what was happening. And I had a slight problem because I was in my pyjamas, my pink pyjamas. I hadn't got my life jacket on, but I immediately put it on as I got out of bed, put on my slippers. And then I had a dressing gown, and now I had a problem because did I put the dressing gown on under the life jacket or on top of the life jacket? And it wouldn't go over the top of the life jacket, and things were beginning to happen rather fast. So I thought, I mustn't panic. On the other hand, I must think this thing through rationally. I'd also had my cork life jacket that they'd got, which was four large slices of cork, two on the front of the body and two on the back, held by a canvas harness. Now, where did that go? Well, I hadn't really thought this thing through properly. So I couldn't put the cork harness on. I got my dressing gown in my other arm, and I walked up to my assembly station straight away. And many people said that we'd be hit by another ship in the convoy. I didn't believe them, but I thought, well, if that's true, then there's no real problem. And because as the alarm bells were sounding, I thought, well, let's get out of the cabin and up to the assembly area and get there ourselves. More knowledge of what's going on than staying in my cabin. So that was a proper drill procedure. Now the torpedo struck the stern of the city of Benares on the port side, the left side, and I was on the stern side, on the starboard side, the right side, so that was why I was lucky, because that was just how the seating accommodation was arranged. There was an awful lot of discussion going on up in the reception area as to exactly what had happened, and there was no panic. Quite a lot of people were still in their ordinary clothes, with grown-ups were, and the children were being marshalled to their lifeboats. There were other lifeboats that they were allocated to, being on the other side of the ship. So I didn't see those many children. Being a private evacuee, I was in a allocated to a lifeboat, there were more adults. There was an order that came through that we must now go to our lifeboat stations from the shelter of the lounge where we were. So we then came out onto the decks, which the storm was, I believe this was something like a force 10 gale. So it wasn't very pleasant. So I still didn't know what to do with this ship issue life jacket. as when I had my dressing gown, I still was contemplating what I should do with that as well. And I thought, well, when we get to the lifeboat station, I can probably get myself properly sorted out. The lifeboats began to come down from their position of stowage, which means that the crane-like davits have to be swung out, and then the sailors release the ropes on pulleys, and it comes down in a very jerky way. They don't come down straight, they come down a bit left, front comes down first, and then the back comes down first, so they're all at an uneven rate. The sailors are obviously keen to get the thing done quickly. But finally, the boat, the lifeboat that I was allocated to, came abreast the ship well, and these boats were banging backwards and forwards against the ship's side. And there was this cry of women and children first. So I was one of the first to be put over. My Hungarian journalist escort was there, and he got in the boat to pick me up and put me in the boat. And there was cries that he wasn't a woman or a child, so he should get out of the boat. But he saw I was in the boat, and then he got back on board the liner, as he really wasn't needed anymore. There were really no more small children like myself on the lifeboat. So we sat there, and the next person to sit next to me was the elderly ship's nurse. This lady, I think, sort of took me under her wing as being the nurse. And we were soon full. There was an officer, I think he was the ship's carpenter, was in charge of our lifeboat, and he gave the order for the lifeboat to be lowered to the sea. And as soon as it was lowered, the lifeboat filled with water. So there were shouts about this. The oars in the lifeboat then floated out, and the lifeboat, just the stern and the bow, the very tip of the lifeboat, was out of the water, and the rest was under water but held up by air tanks that were fastened under the seats. And I then had another problem, because now I had a life belt issued by the ship in one hand, my dressing gown in the other one. And everything was beginning to float, including myself, because being quite small, I had a problem to hold on to the seat to prevent myself being taken away by the seas out of the boat altogether. Somebody, so I can remember a ship's officer throwing his cap down to help bail the lifeboat out, but that was totally a ludicrous thing to do. But the ship by this time was now obviously sinking, and the next thing was that we had to get the boat away from the ship, otherwise we could be drawn down by the suction of the sinking ship. They had a system of propeller on the lifeboat which involved levers. I think there were six or eight levers. And the idea was that you push the levers backwards and forwards and this turned the propeller. But it didn't seem to work as far as I was concerned. And as I was much too small and there were much bigger people on board, I let them do that. In the meantime, the elderly lady nurse was having a bit of a problem herself, because the life belt, life jacket she was used to by the ship was not put on properly, and it was all up around her neck. And she got her dressing gown all underneath, and her nightie, or whatever it was. And it was all becoming so much, what with the water, that I held on to her, and she held on to me. But I realised that we could be both swept over the sea, because the seas were just coming in on one side of the lifeboat and going straight throughout the other side, and the seas were very heavy indeed. It's a very strange feeling to realise that when the seas are curling over, it's just like being on the shore when you see the waves crashing, and you think, I didn't realise it was quite like this at sea. And you appreciate that it's an awful long way down, and you're very vulnerable. There are a lot of oil all around at this time too, and the ship was sinking quite fast. There was cries of people, can we get on your lifeboat? Are you in a lifeboat? And it was a lot of confusion, and of course it was pitch black, so there were no lights. The rest of the convoy had gone. Another ship had been sunk as well, a small ship, and they had got proper lifeboats that were not waterlogged, and there was a thought that we could try and get across to them to get into their lifeboat, but there was no way of getting from one place to another place, because the seas were just so immense, and it was really just a mess going up and down on these enormous waves. We were certainly rock steady because we were so full of water, whereas other lifeboats, which were empty or were floating, were turned over by the waves because of the sheer size of the storm. And all the time people were holding on to the side of the lifeboat, not able to get in, and other people who were in the lifeboat were having real problems. And I suppose there were about 40 to 50 people in the lifeboat or around the lifeboat, including quite a few Lascar sailors. These Lascar sailors didn't seem to have any idea of the situation as sailors. They were obviously not used to this cold weather, and they hadn't got proper clothing on, not fit clothing. I let go of my proper life belt, the ship's life belt, because it was an encumbrance, and also my dressing gown, because it was now waterlogged, I couldn't use that. My main concern was looking after a nurse who was beginning to slip down. In other words, I was more or less holding onto her clothes rather than onto her. She seemed to be slipping out of everything. And I was in a real problem now, because I was trying to stay in the lifeboat holding on, and she was in great difficulties. And I'd rather look to her for help and aid at a time like this. It seemed that the roles were reversed. And I could see her was not being very well, the perception. And at the same time, there were other people being swept out of the lifeboat, the Lascars in particular. They were talking in their language and asking all sorts of questions because I didn't understand. And they were being, and one was hoping that they would have a solution to the problem, being sailors, but they didn't seem to have any idea at all. They were in real terror, as like we all were. I think sitting next to me on the other side from the nurse was a gentleman who I later learnt to be called Professor Day, who was an elderly man from Canadian University. And he was sort of gently suggesting to me that this, I should release this nurse, the ship's nurse, as he, in his view, she was dead. And I was so cold that really I couldn't really move my arms and legs. I was holding on for my life, holding on to her, and I really didn't want to let go of her, because I felt that I would then lose whatever resource that I had in my arms. But it then became apparent to me that she was dying and possibly was dead, and I still couldn't let go of her. I just thought that any minute we might be rescued, there might be possibility of life within her, and it seemed to be so. There was no need to let go of her. It would be cruel to let go of her. She was a person, even though she was now patently dead, and her life was over and everything else. And they said, come on, Colin, let go of her, let go of her. I just couldn't do it. And eventually the storm solved the problem and she was swept away. And we were getting fewer and fewer in numbers by now. My main attention was on this lady. But when I looked round, I found there were fewer people in the boat. What was there, a boat left? There was a young man, a young student, an Englishman as far as I know, who said he wanted something to eat or drink. And he started drinking the seawater. And everybody was telling him, the other people were telling him no, in between the waves. So it was very difficult to talk because the waves just were flowing all over you. And he was insistent on it. And the next minute he jumped the right word, from the relative safety of the lifeboat into the sea. And by now we were fewer and fewer people, and the sea was still running high, and dawn was slowly coming, and somebody managed to get out a tin of condensed milk from the store, because it was all underwater, and somebody got a jackknife and managed to punch two holes in the condensed milk tin, and that was the first bit of food I'd had, and the only bit, because the rest of the ship's food in watertight containers was underneath the seats of the lifeboat, and that was 2 or 3 feet under water.
How much of you would have been out of water?
Well, because I was wearing this K-pop lifeboat jacket, I suppose I was chest out of the water. But the problem, of course, wearing a life jacket when the ship is waterlogged is that when a big wave comes through the lifeboat, it takes you out away from the actual structure of the lifeboat, and you're desperately trying to hang on, so you're underwater as you hold on. So the life jacket actually is an impediment to those circumstances, because it's doing the very function you don't want to do, is to be taken away from the relative fragile resource of the lifeboat itself. I mean, it would have been easy for me to let go when I've been swept downwind.
What was there for you to cling on to?
The sea.
The seat. Just that, yes.
I hadn't got my back against anything. I was on the cross seat on the lifeboat, so it was just holding on to the plank of wood underneath my bottom. So it really taxed my strength, because the buoyancy of the life jacket was in opposition to my need to hold on to the seat. When dawn came, you could start seeing one or two other bits of wreckage, lifeboat here, people on an upturned lifeboat. One moment there were there isn't many people on it, and there weren't so many. We didn't know whether they were on the other side of the upturn lifeboat or what. And the seas began to get a little bit calmer, or at least it all seemed more relative, because you were in the daylight when dawn came. You could see further and appreciate where the next waves were coming, because in the night when the wave came, you just didn't know it when it was coming, because it was all black. And so we really just sat there watching people slowly dying left, right and centre. Most of the Lascars had died by early morning and had gone. The Professor Day, he was there. The ship's nurse had now gone. The ship's officer was still there. And he was giving advice what he could do in the storm. And there were one or two other people. In fact, I think there were only about three or four of us left by the time we were picked up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon by the destroyer HMS Hurricane.
That would be three or four, you say, out of about 40, 50 people.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think, you see, we were one of the first lifeboats to be lowered into the water. And it was so we were a full complement quickly completed. And therefore, there was no need for it to hang around, let them get away and let the sailors lowering the lifeboats go on to the next job down the line. So that was, I think, the reason. I think we were number 5 or 6 lifeboat. And I suppose there were probably 8 or 10 on each side of the ship.
Mm-hmm. What sort of kept you going in this situation, Colin? You know, you're talking for many hours, aren't you?
Mm.
You know, from fairly early evening, fairly early night, right the way through the night into the
afternoon of the next day, yes.
Mm. You know, did you do anything to keep your morale and spirits up?
Well, no, I was very tired. I think in a way I was hallucinating at times. You try to imagine that in the moon we're going to see a ship where we rise up on the next wave, and there isn't one. And then you think, well, maybe there is, or maybe it's a bit of wreckage. Well, when we next come up on the next wave, we'll have another look. And there's nothing there. It's gone, or it's got in a valley of another trough. But I mean, trying to see who was left and who was what. Wasn't really, you really had to sit absolutely as still as possible, holding on for dear life. There was no sort of question of what do we do now. I mean, it was a if you like, a nil existence, just staying put because of the seas. Any movement just made people vulnerable. I think the ship's officer was the one to get the food out of the container and try and make life a little more comfortable in the lifeboat, but so little equipment was left, and the sails had gone, the mast had gone, the oars had gone, so anything that was movable had gone. But as I say, I think apart from the condensed milk, that was all I had.